From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, soprano Dawn Upshaw. This month she premieres a new show at Lincoln Center featuring the songs of Stephen Sondheim, Kurt Weill, George Gershwin, and Vernon Duke. We'll feature her 1999 interview recorded after the release of her CD, Dawn Upshaw Sings Vernon Duke. Duke is best known for his songs April in Paris, Autumn in New York, and Taking a Chance on Love. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a box set of Sonny Rollins recordings from the late 50s, and film critic John Powers reviews Gladiator, directed by Ridley Scott, starring Russell Crowe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Pentagon officials now acknowledge that the so-called love bug computer virus has even penetrated classified computer systems. NPR's Steve Inskeep reports.
Pentagon officials initially said the virus never reached any secret computer networks. Now, a spokesman says it did. Four classified systems began receiving countless copies of the message, "I love you," the same message that has clogged many corporate email systems. In a statement, Pentagon officials insist they caught the virus quickly, and they say it did not affect military operations. But the statement doesn't say if the virus affected any intelligence operations, and officials privately confirm the bug struck at least one intelligence agency, the National Security Agency. Among many other things, the NSA is responsible for computer security, protecting the government from viruses like this one. It is not clear how the virus got in. At least in theory, classified computer systems are supposed to be almost completely walled off from the Internet. Steve Inskeep, NPR News, Washington.
The nation's unemployment rate dropped to 3.9% in April. The Labor Department said that 340,000 people found jobs during the month, helping to bring the jobless rate to its lowest level since 1970. The unemployment rates for blacks dropped to a record monthly low of 7.2%, while the jobless rate for Hispanics hit an all-time low of 5.4%. The overall drop in the unemployment rate was bigger than most analysts had been predicting. On a campaign trip to Michigan today, Vice President Al Gore released details of his proposed education agenda. The plan includes spending $8 billion over the next decade to lure 1 million new teachers into classrooms. Rick Pluter reports from Michigan Public Radio.
Outlining his plan to teachers' union members, the vice president called for using federal funds to recruit new teachers to replace retiring educators. He also called for boosting teachers' pay, but in return, he said, teachers would have to sharpen their skills and accept rules that make it easier to fire poor teachers.
I want to build an America where you are respected and rewarded, and where we expect the very best from you. I want to build an America where teaching takes its rightful place among the most honored of all professions.
Republicans say Gore's plan relies too much on the federal bureaucracy to improve local schools. Earlier, Gore visited a high school and helped teach a history class on civil rights and integrating schools. For NPR News, I'm Rick Pluta in Lansing, Michigan.
In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 165 points, or nearly 1.6%, to close at 10,577. Advances led declines by 4-3 in heavy trading of 799 million shares. The NASDAQ Composite Index gained 96 points, or 2.6%, to close at 3,817. This is NPR News. In Northern Ireland, the British and Irish prime ministers have made a new push for peace. They've announced a deal to restore power to Northern Ireland's Catholic and Protestant administration by May 22nd. The United Nations now says more than 300 of its peacekeepers in Sierra Leone are being held captive. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
The peacekeepers, most of them troops from other African nations, were seized over the past 2 days by soldiers of the Revolutionary United Front, a rebel group waging war against Sierra Leone's government. Both sides signed a peace pact last year, and more than 8,000 UN troops were sent to help implement the deal. It's not yet clear why the rebels are holding the UN troops, but it's believed at least four peacekeepers were killed earlier this week when the trouble broke out. The rebels have also taken 13 of the UN's white personnel carriers, which they are apparently using to reposition some of their own troops. Secretary General Kofi Annan said he favors sending in a rapid reaction force to help the peacekeepers, possibly from the U.S., Great Britain, or France. But so far, no commitments have been made. The rebels also seized the light arms of nearly 100 Nigerian peacekeepers. Mike Schuster, NPR News, New York.
Students and teachers at Columbine High School are grieving the death of a star basketball player who committed suicide at his home. Word of the death of Columbine junior Greg Barnes came just 2 weeks after the school and the community of Littleton, Colorado, observed the one-year anniversary of the Columbine High School massacre in which 15 people died. The school district provided counselors at the school to help comfort students, and substitute teachers were on call to take the places of teachers who wanted to stay home. A school district spokesman said the boy's death did not happen at school and did not involve guns. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from SBC Communications, sponsor of Washington Week in Review, insight, conversation, and analysis of the week's issues moderated by Gwen Ifill, tonight at 8 on PBS.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Don Upshaw is a celebrated opera singer and interpreter of American popular song. Last Sunday, the Lincoln Center Great Performers Series began its three-part project, Images of Dawn, presenting her in three different settings. The final part of the project is the world premiere of Roundabout, featuring Upshaw and baritone Greg Edelman, performing songs by Stephen Sondheim, Kurt Weill, George Gershwin, and Vernon Duke. On this archive edition, we have a 1999 interview with Upshaw, recorded after the release of her CD, Dawn Upshaw Sings Vernon Duke. Duke's best-known songs include April in Paris, Autumn in New York, I Can't Get Started, and Taking a Chance on Love. He collaborated with such lyricists as Yip Harburg, Ira Gershwin, and Howard Dietz. But Duke wrote the words and music for his song Autumn in New York. Here's Upshaw's recording.
It's time to end my lonely holiday and bid the country a hasty farewell. So on this gray and melancholy day, I'll move to a Manhattan hotel. I'll dispose of my rose-colored chattels and prepare for my share of adventures and battles. Here on the 27th floor, looking down on the city I hate and adore. Autumn in New York, why does it seem so inviting?
Music from the CD, Dawn Upshaw Sings Vernon Duke. Joining Upshaw for our interview was her producer Tommy Krasker, an expert on music theater who has also produced several Broadway cast recordings and recordings of music theater restorations. Vernon Duke thought of himself as having two separate musical personalities. He wrote classical music for orchestras and ballets under his birth name, Vladimir Dukhelsky, and he wrote songs for Broadway and Hollywood under the name Vernon Duke. And in his autobiography, he says, there isn't a note of jazz in my serious music, and there are no symphonic overtones to my musical comedy output. I don't think that's anything to be proud of. And the wide gulf between the two styles has proven entirely too wide for most people's comfort, particularly for critics and fellow composers. Don Upshaw, I was wondering if you identify with his feeling, because you have two separate identities, too, in a way. You use the same name, but you're working in the opera world and the world of art song, and you're also working now in the world of songs from movies and musical theater. Do you identify with the sense of having two different identities and some people being uncomfortable with that?
I've certainly hoped that there's a big difference in my approach in performance style between the more classical music and the Broadway music that I've been singing. At the same time, though, I've really learned a lot by getting back to the more popular music about simplicity and straightforwardness and kind of no baloney. And I've realized that maybe even in my training in classical music, there's been this approach that it's such high art that it's unattainable and that it's anything but down to earth. And so I've been trying to bring that end of my work back into the real world. And so in that way, I'm trying to bring them together, in fact.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense. Vernon Duke, in his autobiography, pointed out that, there were other composers who wrote both symphonic and pop music, Gershwin and Bernstein and Kurt Weill, but Duke thought that whether they were writing the symphonic or the pop music, you still recognize them as themselves, whereas he felt that Duke Helsky was in no way resembling Duke. And I wonder if you agree with that Duke Helsky, the name he used to write his classical works, was really different from the Vernon Duke pop music. Because it seems to me that there's a strain of art song in the pop music, too.
Yeah, I certainly think, I don't know a lot of the Dukelsky music, although we did include, of course, one art song, mm-hmm. one song from a song cycle on this recording, and I think it blends beautifully into the more popular songs. I certainly do know the Broadway songs, and they are incredibly complex. They are certainly much more complex, melodically daring, harmonically challenging and chromatic than the typical song of the day. So even if he felt, I guess, that those worlds were very dissimilar, he was certainly writing a much more serious strain of pop song than most of his fellow composers of that day.
Well, I want to play one of the pop songs that Vernon Duke wrote that sounds almost like an art song to me, and it's not officially an art song. It's a song called Water Under the Bridge, and it has a lyric by Yip Harburg, who also wrote the lyric for one of Vernon Duke's most famous songs, April in Paris. And Vernon Duke described this song, Water Under the Bridge, as a weird mood song. He says, Yip Harburg and I wrote for Everett Marshall to sing and Patricia Bowman to dance. This was probably the first of the out-of-this-world songs that I wrote. Not heavenly, just plain uncommercial. And Vernon Duke's publisher apparently refused to publish the song, saying, if you can't sing it, and Vernon Duke said he couldn't sing it, then how do you expect to sell copies of this? Dawn Upshaw, is this a hard song to sing?
I don't find it vocally demanding. I think for its time, harmonically, it's way out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't think, when they say, if you can't sing it, how are we supposed to sell it? They're talking about a general public that wanted to sit down at their pianos at home and play along while they sang a simple melody. And it was a bit too difficult and complicated to do that. So I think for the general public, that's what he's talking about, that it won't sell.
I think the song is in some way extremely complex for 1932, when you recognize what publishers were looking for, of course, were, jingly songs that would create instant sheet music sales. I think that's also one reason now music has become more complex. We're used to the complexities of the song, which is why I think that Vernon Duke is certainly due for a rediscovery now, is what once seemed unfamiliar or scary to a publisher in 1932 certainly doesn't seem that way to a vocalist today.
Good points. Well, let's hear Water Under the Bridge, music by Vernon Duke, a lyric by Yip Harburg, and the singer is my guest, Dawn Upshaw. It's really a beautiful song. Tommy Kresger, did you find that song?
Yeah, actually, it was Vernon Duke's autobiography, Passport to Paris, that led me to that song. We had, Don and I'd put together a list of songs that interested us, and as we were in the final stages of putting together the recording, I decided I would take one more look at Duke's autobiography to see if he led me towards certain material. And of course, he talked about that number and how daring it was for the time and how his publishers wouldn't publish it. And I thought, I'd love to get my hands on that. Of course, it was hard. It wasn't published. The Yip Harburg Foundation actually had a very sketchy lead sheet of it, which I was able to get a copy of. And I could see from that it was a song that interested me and might interest Dawn. I was very fortunate, however, because Duke had recorded it, and I was able to locate an old 78 of his arrangement of him playing the piano with a clarinetist and a vocalist from, I guess, 1934, and we heard it. We liked it. We knew we couldn't actually do better than that, and so we lifted that arrangement. So what you're actually hearing, which is rather unique, I think, is Vernon Duke's own arrangement of his song that he did in 1934, reinterpreted by Don Upshaw and Eric Stern, our pianist and conductor.
My guests are singer Dawn Upshaw and the producer of her music theater CDs, Tommy Kresger. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1999 interview with Dawn Upshaw and music theater expert Tommy Kresger, who produced her American popular song CDs. Vernon Duke wrote classical music when he lived in Russia, and he lived there till he was in his late teens. He came to America in 1921 and didn't start writing pop songs for musicals until several years after that, and I believe he was encouraged by George Gershwin. Tommy Kresger, do you know how he met Gershwin and what Gershwin did to help Vernon Duke?
Well, as I understand the story, he was in the United States basically earning a living any way he could as a pianist. I think he was playing for magic acts and things. And George Gershwin heard him, and he befriended him. Duke, whose name was Vladimir Dukelsky, played him some things that he had written. And George Gershwin basically said, look, you have a great talent, but to be quite honest with you, I've discovered that there's no money in that particular field. If you want to earn a living, you need to start writing popular tunes. He gave him the name, actually, Vernon Duke, at that point, and said, when you get around to writing popular things, that's the name you should use. Dukelsky then went back to Europe, wrote some ballets, wrote some symphonies, but I think eventually decided George Gershwin was right. He moved back to America, I think, around 1929. George set him up with a budding lyricist friend of his brother Ira's named Yip Harburg, and they became a songwriting team. And suddenly there was a new Broadway composer named Vernon Duke writing a series of reviews for Broadway.
How well did he fit in on Broadway and in Hollywood?
I think it took a while, certainly, for the critics to adjust to him. He was certainly writing a much more complex kind of art song than they were used to. And I think it's rather telling, actually, that his first song hit was April in Paris, just a couple of years after he arrived in the States. And the song itself, of course, is a major achievement, and everybody knows it now, but I think we've sort of forgotten what an unusual song it is. Very chromatic, melodically, with some soaring skips in the melody that make it rather challenging, I think, and difficult to sing. The critics pretty much didn't notice that song when it premiered in, I think, 1932. They simply didn't know what to make of it. And I would say it wasn't really until the mid-30s that the critics understood that, yes, he was complex, but he was also brilliant.
I'm glad you mentioned April in Paris. It's one of Vernon Duke's best-known songs, and I think his first pop music success.
Yes.
Dawn Upshaw, do you think of it as a challenging song?
No, not really. I think, as Tommy said, you know, people's ears and the musical language changes over the years, and we become much more accustomed to hearing certain kinds of surprises harmonically or leaps that were not so common in one time become more understandable, or we were conditioned to hearing them and understanding them after years. I think that there actually were a couple moments in some other songs that I didn't know as well. Of course, I've grown up hearing April in Paris, but there were some other places and other songs that I did have to, you know, get down at the piano and make sure I was singing the right notes and play along with myself. So it did happen occasionally, and then I would get it into my ear.
You said that you didn't include the song I Can't Get Started because so many people had done it before and you didn't know what new you could bring to it. Now, April in Paris has been a jazz standard for years, and so many people have recorded it. Tell me what you wanted to bring to your version of April in Paris.
I really enjoyed singing it, first of all. I find it gratifying to sing. In terms of the message, I thought, well, if I really get down to exactly what this is about, this sort of feeling, a description of what's going on, is something that I have felt before. And I think that I, for whatever reasons, related better to it at this time in my life than I did I Can't Get Started. And it could be that I would change my mind, you know, in 5 years about that. But at the time that we were getting together and going through the pieces together and talking to arrangers about where can we take this song? How might we shape it? Do we want to start with the chorus or with the verse? What kind of mood do we want to set? Everything seemed to make sense to include April in Paris.
April in Paris, chestnuts in blossom, holiday tables on.
Has recording more pop songs changed the music that you listen to, if you have time to actually listen to records when you're at home?
I always listened really to a lot of different kinds of music. Certainly Joni Mitchell and Aretha Franklin, Steely Dan. I have been listening. I guess I've listened to more Frank Sinatra, actually, since I've been working on the popular music. And I've been turning on the radio to some popular stations certainly more often than I would have before.
I'd be interested in hearing you talk about Sinatra. What do you like about his singing?
I like the fact that I feel it's relaxed and spontaneous at the same time, and that there is a true personality coming through every minute. I don't feel like he's thinking about the sound he's producing. Again, we're getting back to the same sort of thing. It's interesting because I've had this conversation with people who do not agree with me about Frank Sinatra. I think that, of course, he has a huge following out there, but believe it or not, there are some people who don't get it. And I think the fact that it does sound so relaxed turns some people off. But for me, it seems like something completely natural, and I'm attracted to that.
I'm with you.
Don Upshaw and music theater expert Tommy Krasker recorded after the release of Upshaw's CD of Vernon Duke songs. Duke is one of the songwriters represented in her new show, Roundabout, which premieres May 17th as part of Lincoln Center's Great Performers series. Upshaw and Krasker will be back in the second half of this archive edition. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet, on the web, worldwildlife.org. From Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Mother of My Mother, The Intricate Bond Between Generations by Hope Edelman. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Inc.'s Style Press Division, publisher of The Running Mate, a new novel of politics by Joe Klein, author of Primary Colors. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more songs by Vernon Duke as we continue our conversation with singer Dawn Upshaw and producer Tommy Krasker. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a box set of Sonny Rollins recordings from the late 50s, which includes this Vernon Duke Yip Harburg song, What Is There to Say? And John Powers reviews the new film, Gladiator. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1999 interview with singer Dawn Upshaw and music theater expert Tommy Krasker, who produced her American popular song CDs. Later this month, as part of Lincoln Center's Great Performers series, Upshaw will premiere Roundabout, featuring songs by Stephen Sondheim, Kurt Vile, George Gershwin, and Vernon Duke. Our interview was recorded after the release of her CD of Vernon Duke songs. Here's a song, The Love I Long For.
The love I long for, I've no right to demand, but I'd make much of the touch of a tender hand. The love I long for. Care when my spirit is low,
the things I particularly like about this new CD is that you've managed to include, you know, a few familiar Vernon Duke songs, and you've managed to include a lot of really virtually unknown Vernon Duke songs that are quite beautiful. I think that's a kind of almost daring thing to do, in the sense that I think most of us expect pop music to be familiar, and there's a special pleasure that we all have as we listen to a familiar pop song sung, because we sing along with it in our minds. And hearing that melody take all those familiar twists and turns, you know, that's one of the things we all, I think, really like about pop music. So I think it's a kind of daring thing to do, to take unfamiliar songs and present them.
I mean, the truth about Vernon Duke's music is so much of it is unfamiliar, and I think we're really able to show with this CD, and one of the things I'm most proud of is we really do show that, I mean, songs don't necessarily die because they're bad. The truth of Vernon Duke, of course, is he was very successful in the 30s when he was writing reviews and could do these brilliant songs like April in Paris and Autumn in New York, and the shows were by and large successful, so the songs endured. In the 40s, Broadway took a different turn, and musical review turned into a musical play with the Rodgers and Hammerstein era. Vernon Duke really didn't seem to have a particular aptitude for that. The demands of the musical play, finding the right collaborators, finding a good theme, really putting the pieces together very carefully, was something that eluded him. And one by one in the 40s and 50s, his shows just failed. I mean, a lot of them didn't even get to Broadway. They just closed out of town. And with the failure of these shows went some wonderful songs that were never published, were never heard. I mean, Lord knows there weren't a lot of sheet music sales. There weren't dance bands playing them. There obviously wasn't a movie version of a show that was going to close out of town. So what happened was, as these shows died, all of these wonderful songs just got buried.
Well, I'd like to feature a song that really did get buried. And Tommy Kresker, this is a song that you basically had to track down and restore. The song is called Roundabout. Tell us what existed of this song before you track down the rest of it.
Sure. Roundabout is a song that Vernon Duke and Ogden Nash wrote for a 1946 musical called Sweet By and By. And Sweet By and By was another one of those Vernon Duke shows that, I don't know, I think he called it a real stinker in his autobiography or something like that. It was closed out of town. I mean, I think it closed in Philadelphia. And so, of course, the score never really got heard. They loved the song, and I think Roundabout is actually Vernon Duke's own favorite of all his songs. They loved the song so much, they kept trying to put it in later works, and I think it later found a place in a show called The Littlest Review. But it was it was really like an art song, very long, 5 or 6 minute song. Well, of course, they did publish it, but they published it in a very simplified version with just a verse and a refrain. And it was when I was working in the mid-80s, in Secaucus, New Jersey, actually, at the Warner Brothers Music Warehouse, where a huge discovery of musical theater manuscripts had been found, that I chanced upon a lot of the score to Sweet By and By, and found this manuscript version of the interlude, a 2-minute interlude of this song, just the music, no lyric. And I held on to it because I recognized the quality of it. And later, I was digging through some materials at the New York Public Library, and I found the lyric to this interlude. So, I mean, this was a song that actually took me a couple years of digging to put back together. And I think I'm fairly secure in saying that what we're presenting on this new CD is the full version of Roundabout, as it really hasn't been heard since Sweet By and By played out of town in 1946.
And which is the part of the lyric that you found?
The lyric of the middle interlude.
You wake each morning alive and gay. You think today is another day.
Don Upshaw, did you like the song when you first saw it?
I loved the song. This was one of, and remains one of my favorites. It is one of the simplest tunes in a sense, but what he does musically actually is describe what he's got in the lyric by Ogden Nash. And that is that, you know, the notes in the chorus, you go roundabout and roundabout and roundabout you go, so they're all kind of sliding around this one note, and no, it doesn't travel much distance, and that's sort of the whole point, that through life, even though we have different experiences and different loves, essentially we're reliving our mistakes every day, and perhaps nothing ever changes.
I will say one thing about the part of the song we found. It's so telling that that middle interlude, of course, was not published, because, as Dawn said, the rest of the song sits in a fairly limited range. This middle interlude on lines like, "And that's the moment not to be astounded to find that you've been merry-go-round," it is full of these wild melodic skips, and it really does take a certain kind of singer to pull that off and to make it seem natural.
Tell me, Kresge, you say you first stumbled onto this song when you were working in the Warner Brothers warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
What were you doing there? That must have been interesting.
There was a huge discovery of musical theater manuscripts sometime in the early 80s, I guess, which included Gershwin, Porter, Rodgers and Hart, along with Arlen Duke, Arthur Schwartz. And sometime in the mid-80s, they were cataloging, and I was pulled in to help catalog that material. As I said, some of the material that impressed me the most at the time, mostly because I didn't know it. I mean, the Gershwin was great and the Porter was great, but I knew a lot of those songs. I was so impressed by the Vernon Duke material. And as I think I mentioned to you, the one of the shows that was there in manuscript form, one of the lost shows, was this Vernon Duke show, Sweet By and By. I happen to think it's one of his finest achievements, but again, totally forgotten. And from that, actually, for this recording, we pulled several numbers that haven't been heard in 50 years, including Roundabout, including a gorgeous ballad called Born Too Late, which was originally written for Sweet By and By, although it wasn't heard until about 10 years later, and a novelty piece called Seagull and the Eagle. Oh, I guess one more as well, Low and Lazy.
Oh, that's right.
It's an example of an incredible score that simply got buried when a show folded.
Dawn Upshaw, it must be really interesting for you to take a song that hasn't been sung much before, that isn't familiar, and interpret it, because you don't have to worry about doing something different from what everybody else has done. You could just do it how you want to do it and not even think about other interpretations.
Yeah, that is a definite advantage. I think it also keeps me thinking and tries... I think it keeps me true, I hope, to the text when I'm not worried about how others have done it in the past.
When you look life in the face, there's too much time, there's too much space, there's too much future, too much past. Man is so little and the world so vast. You may fancy yourself as an immortal creature, but you're just a cartoon between a double feature. Wound about the game, then it's ringed around and swing around your partners as you go. But the more they change, the more they are the same. When the dancing is done,
Roundabout from Dawn Upshaw Sings Vernon Duke. Her new program of songs called Roundabout premieres May 17th as part of the Lincoln Center Great Performer Series. It features songs by Duke, Weill, Gershwin, and Sondheim. Our interview with Upshaw and music theater expert Tommy Krasker was recorded last year. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a box set of Sonny Rollins recordings from the 50s. This is Fresh Air. From 1956 to 58, when tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins' reputation was at an early peak, he was without a recording contract and made records for a few labels, including Blue Note, for whom he made a classic live album at the Village Vanguard. The sides he recorded for the Riverside and Contemporary labels are collected in a new box set. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
In the 1950s, Sonny Rollins loved to push the tempo, to play very, very fast, but make it sound like more than just wiggling his fingers. That speed was a big part of his emerging reputation as a saxophone colossus, that and his big, ripe sound. But the cornerstone of Rollins' art is how he keeps a melody in mind. As composer, he's known for jam session anthems like Olio and Sunny Moon for Two, but he's also written some deft but almost childlike themes that sound plucked from the air. If that last phrase sounds oddly familiar, it's lifted from the 40s hit, Swingin' on a Star. That's Sonny Rollins' Way Out West, title track from the album where he played fake cowboy songs Wagon Wheels and I'm an Old Cowhand. Its famous cover photo, by William Claxton, was a faded image of Rollins decked out as a gunslinger with a saxophone. The tune Way Out West is tricky to play, but still sounds a little like it fell off a chuck wagon. Rollins knows a melody with simple but strong ideas can inspire an improviser better than some complicated tunes. Like one of his idols, Coleman Hawkins, Rollins could abstract from a tune and still get to the heart of it, could unlock its logic and see what features really define it. That made him a good ally of composer and pianist Thelonious Monk. Like Monk, he could edit his lines down to a few right but unlikely notes. Timing. Rollins can approach the beat from any angle and never stumble. His phrases are unpredictable, but you can still hear where his roots are. Charlie Parker is a model for his pacing and drive, and Coleman Hawkins for the robust tone, but his attention to melody and variation harks back to Louis Armstrong. Also like Armstrong, Rollins makes repeated notes bounce like a trampoline. This is The Last Time I Saw Paris with Roy Haynes on drums. Rollins made 7 albums for Riverside or Contemporary in the 1950s, 4 as a leader and 3 as a sideman. No 2 had the same cast, though a few folks make repeat appearances. Drummers Max Roach and Shelly Mann, bassists Oscar Pettiford and Paul Chambers, and trumpeter Kenny Durham. As a hired gun, Rollins backed Monk, Durham, and singer Abby Lincoln. With her, he could be both brash and discreet in the space of a few seconds. Box, Sonny Rollins, The Freelance Years, the complete Riverside and Contemporary recordings, is loaded with great and good music. Rollins fans probably know most of the stuff, as almost all of it is out already. The Monk, Kenny Durham, and Abby Lincoln albums he played on also include a few tracks where Rollins doesn't appear, which naturally enough didn't make the box. It does, however, have Rollins' half of a 1957 album for the Period label, with Gil Coggins on piano, and one new-to-CD alternate take of You from 1958. Folks do like box sets, and as jazz boxes go these days, this one is refreshingly understated design-wise. Hey, it's got 6 hours of Sonny Rollins in one of his peak periods. They shouldn't have to put a ribbon on it.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed Sonny Rollins' The Freelance Years, the complete Riverside and Contemporary recordings. Coming up, the Roman epic is back. This is Fresh Air. Steve Reeves died Monday. He was the star of the 1959 film Hercules and other low-budget sword and sandal epics. Today, the summer movie season began with Gladiator, the kind of costume epic set in ancient times that Hollywood hasn't made in years, but echoes those Steve Reeves films. Gladiator is directed by Ridley Scott and stars Russell Crowe and Joaquin Phoenix. Film critic John Powers has a review.
I spent my childhood watching movies about the Roman Empire. Bombastic Ben-Hur, campy Spartacus, badly dubbed epics starring Steve Reeves. I loved them all, which is why no movie this year had me more revved up than Gladiator. I was hungry for that bread in those circuses. And for a while, the movie lived up to my dreams. clearly taking its structure from Saving Private Ryan. It begins with an amazing and an amazingly violent battle between the Imperial Romans and the tribes of Germania, a battle whose style weds the kinetic power of Spielberg with the poetry of the Hong Kong director Wong Kar-wai. Watching all this killing, you're reminded what a dirty business the Roman Empire really was. When the smoke clears, the story begins. The victorious General Maximus, that's Russell Crowe, is eager to go home. But the dying emperor, Marcus Aurelius, played by Richard Harris, asks Maximus to go back to Rome as his successor and give power back to the Senate. This doesn't set too well with the emperor's ambitious but unreliable son, Commodus, who's played by Joaquin Phoenix. When he hears that he doesn't get to take over Rome, he orders Maximus and his family wiped out. Naturally, Maximus escapes, but his wife and kid don't. They're slaughtered and dispatched to an afterlife, which, as conceived by director Ridley Scott, looks suspiciously like a commercial for a luxury car. There's no luxury for the despondent Maximus, who's captured and carted to North Africa, where he's forced to become a gladiator. He hopes to fight his way back to Rome, where he can kill Commodus, who, to woo the Roman mob, has been staging huge bloody games at the Colosseum. Along the way, Maximus gets help from the man who owns him, a gruff ex-gladiator named Proximo, played with delightfully hammy relish by the late Oliver Reed. Here, Proximo teaches his star warrior what it takes to make it in the gladiator biz.
You ask me what I want. I too want to stand in front of the emperor. As you did.
Then listen to me. Learn from me. I wasn't the best because I killed quickly. I was the best because the crowd loved me. Win the crowd, and you'll win your freedom.
I will win the crowd. I will give them something they've never seen before.
So, Spaniard, we shall go to Rome together and have bloody adventures. And the great whore will suckle us until we are fat and happy and can suckle no more. And then, when enough men have died, perhaps you will have your freedom.
Although Gladiator is enjoyable enough, it lacks the pop of great pop culture. Roman movies usually have preposterous scripts, but this one is preposterous and doleful, as if the filmmakers actually believe they're saying something serious about blood sport, or the so-called freedom of Rome. The lesser characters barely register, and the story doesn't build with any momentum. The opening battle is the high point, and Maximus's final showdown with Commodus is more of a whimper than a bang. But Scott's directing deserves some blame, too. He lays on far too much blood for a movie as hokey as this one, and his fight scenes lack the wit and invention I'd expect from the director of Alien, Blade Runner, and Thelma and Louise. Even when Maximus is forced to battle a champion gladiator, with tigers springing up from traps to menace him, and the movie's editor working overtime, it's hard to get caught up in the action. As Maximus, Crowe has the commanding physicality of a general or a gladiator. He seems like a real man of the old school. But his is a boringly noble Chuck Heston role, and to play such a part requires something more, or perhaps something less, than good acting. It requires a vainglorious movie star sheen, the kind Heston or Kirk Douglas had in spades. A born character actor, Crowe prefers to immerse himself in a role, which only works when a character has something going on beneath the surface. The movie's at its best when we're watching the shifty Commodus, who boasts the usual accessories of decadent emperorhood, including lust for his own sister, played by the mysterious Connie Nielsen. It's a plum role, and Joaquin Phoenix plucks it, wittily capturing Commodus's curdled love for his father and his oddball blend of cringing and bravado. It's such an amusing performance that I kept hoping the mad emperor might actually win. But that would never happen in a Hollywood movie, only in Hollywood itself.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shirok directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thank you.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Random House, Inc., Crown Publishers Division, hardcover publishers of Ordinary Resurrections, Children in the Years of Hope by Jonathan Kozol. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Incorporated's Delta Trade Paperback Division, publisher of Mother of My Mother, The Intricate Bond Between Generations by Hope Edelman. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, writer Philip Roth. His new novel, The Human Stain, completes a trilogy of novels about the impact of McCarthyism, Vietnam, and political correctness on the lives of individuals. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.